After seeing what Ross did to that dear brother, I'm a little nervous. I overheard some talk that they may start handling giving that way. People that are kind of falling behind, they'll just give them a little douse when they come to church on Sunday. So just wanted to forewarn you for that. We are at the end of 5 weeks, the end of 10, actually, if we take into account last summer. And I want to tell you at the front end, because I think when I get to the tail end, I'll be fighting the clock and fatigue. And I'll end, being that I'm going to be 57 this summer, I'll be fighting my memory to recall to do this. So I just want to thank you for letting me come. It's been fun for me. I love teaching people that like to learn and appreciate the scriptures more than they appreciate me. And that's, I hope God keeps it that way. We have been looking at this whole idea of this Latin phrase, ecce homo, behold the man, which Pilate said at one point in his interrogation with Jesus. And we're going to actually read that passage tonight, a little lengthy passage, but we're going to spend some time looking at our last character this evening. Before we do that, I want to take a little trip back and look at what we had kind of been looking at, not all five sessions or four sessions prior to this one, but just particularly the one we did last week. We had talked about this guy named Andrew, who was Simon Peter's brother. And again, I'm trying to distill some of the things that we looked at. And one of the things that we saw from John the Baptist passing this on to Andrew, and we saw that Andrew picked it up really well, was John's vision of being the one that prepared the way, the one that pointed people to Jesus, the one that was so committed to that mission that he was willing to take his entire following and just turn them over to Jesus. And we kind of said that really when it comes to being a follower of Jesus, that it really is more important that people, that we point them to whom we're following rather than how we're doing it. And I'm not sure if I need to unpack that a little bit, but, you know, just real briefly, we're saying this, is that a true follower of Jesus is trying to point others to Jesus and not to ourselves. Not to ourselves in terms of what we don't do, not to ourselves in terms of what we're against, but Jesus himself. You know, it was really interesting. I was teaching at a university not too long ago, and a girl told me, she said, you know, Mr. Shaka, she said, we're really struggling with kind of what to call ourselves on the campus. And I said, why? And she said, well, she said, if you use the word Christian on this campus, people immediately assume, and then she began to list a bunch of things you're against and a bunch of things that you don't do. And she said, Jesus isn't even on the table. He's not even in the discussion. People tend to think of a Christian in terms of their political persuasion or their behaviors or what they're against. And when we look at this thing we looked at last week and we see Andrew was like John the Baptist, he just brought people to Jesus. That was his main passion. Second thing, and I kind of phrased this a little bit odd, but we talked about the fact that a true follower of Jesus follows Jesus for himself, not because of what he gives. It's not that your life gets easier if you're a Christian. Matter of fact, if you've been walking with the Lord any length of time, I would guess that you've come to the conclusion that in many ways life gets more difficult because you start to see things you didn't see before in your own heart. You start to have to deal with things that you were content to not deal with before. You're finding you have a whole different motivation for treating people differently and so on. I'm really hesitant to tell people that coming to Jesus, life will just get better. It improves because it gets closer to what it's supposed to be, but it's more difficult. The late G.K. Chesterton, he died around the turn of the century, but he made a profound statement when he said Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. He said it's been found difficult and not tried. And I think when it comes to this notion of following Jesus, we follow him because he is worthy. He is the lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world. The third point is that we saw this with John the Baptist, we saw it with Andrew, that true followers of Jesus are not following anyone or anything else. They're not following a political party. They're not following a sporting team, even though they may be a fan. Their real allegiance is with the one whose name they now bear. And that's kind of some of the things that we saw in a little bit different portrait last week when we looked at this fourth person, Simon Peter's brother, whose name was Andrew. And what I want to do this week is take a look at our last character. And it's a person that is probably as well known as Judas Iscariot or Simon Peter or Doubting Thomas. And his name is Pontius Pilatus. We just know him as Pilate. And he plays a vital, vital role in Christianity and in the gospel itself. I want to read from the Gospel of John. I've printed most of it in there, but I ran out of space, and so I did some ellipses in there. But if you want to just listen along, you're welcome to read if you want to. Starting in John chapter 18. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They being the Jewish leaders, did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them. What accusation do you bring against this man? They answered him, if this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him up to you. Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. And the Jews said to him, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. They did not have the right of capital punishment. This was to fulfill the word Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. They could technically stone people from time to time, but they didn't want him stoned. They wanted him crucified, and they couldn't do that. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, my kingdom's not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might be delivered over to not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. So Pilate said to him, so you are a king? And Jesus answered, you say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? After he said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man to you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? And they cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers, that right there, that sentence right there, beloved, is the entirety of Mel Gibson's film in that verse. John just, it's not a big deal to John. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, hail, King of the Jews, and struck him with their hands. Pilate went on again and said to them, see, I'm bringing him to you that you may know that I find no fault in him. So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and purple robe, and Pilate said to him, behold the man, ecce homo. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, crucify him, crucify him. And Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. Now this is where things heat up. The Jews answered him, we have a law, and according to that law he ought to die, because he has made himself the Son of God. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate said, will you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and I have the authority to crucify you? And Jesus said, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. When Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, behold your king. They cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered them over to be crucified. You know, we're getting very near the Easter season. This is probably a good person for us to end our time with. We're going to follow the same thing that we had followed before. We're going to try to get behind the text on this one. Tons of stuff on this. And I'm going to just give you a little bit, but hopefully it'll be enough to change the way you read this story from this time on. And you'll get a chance, I'm sure, to read it at some point in church during the Easter season. But let's take a look at the world behind the text. There's a number of things that we need to know about this man, Pilate. And I want to do a little bit of a comparison between image versus substance. By that, I mean what he appeared, how a Roman prefect appeared, a procurator, and how he really was. Because there's a vast discrepancy between those two, and I want to help you understand that. I also want to help you understand, in a very real sense, be a little bit more sympathetic with Pilate, not necessarily forgiving, although you and I have an obligation as believers to be forgiving, but help us understand the picture, help us understand the circumstances, help us understand what really happened to this guy. Pilate was a man of three things for sure. He was a man of prestige, he was a man of privilege, and he was a man of power. Just by virtue of him being what our Bible calls governor or prefect. How do we know that? Mainly because in order for him to be a prefect, he had to be from one of the top three orders in Roman society. Top order was the senatorial order. Right beneath that was the equestrian, and then below that was the decorum. And the equestrians and senatorial orders combined, made up less than 0.1% of all the people in the Mediterranean. They were the cream of the cream. It was 0.001% of the people in the Mediterranean that were in the senatorial order. I mean, these are a very, very small number of people who were highly, highly influential. And so just by virtue, we tend to, you probably have heard stories or even read about Pilate that he was kind of at the bottom of the food chain, that Judea was the armpit of the known world, and just by being there, he was already just relegated to the bottom. He may have been. Judea was not any prize plum for any Roman officer. But the fact that he was in the equestrian order put him at the very top of the food chain, even though he's at the bottom of the top rung, if that makes sense. He was something else, just by virtue of his class in society. He was tremendously wealthy, even though it's never said that. How do we know that? Because in order to become an equestrian, either to be born into it and then finally get that status, you had to be worth a certain number of sesterces or of denarii. In our terms, it works out to be about $1 million just to be in it. It's scary, the wealth that some of these people had. There was two senators that were living in the first century that each of them, each of their individual wealth in modern day dollars was $20 billion. So these are highly, highly wealthy people. In order to even be in the military, as a Roman, you supply your own horse. So you had to have the money to do that. That's where we get our word equestrian. Originally started out with soldiers in the Roman army, but they weren't drafted and given everything like we do in the U.S. It'd be kind of like if you were on a football team and had to buy all your own gear. That would automatically eliminate that sport for a lot of people in this country. But he was very wealthy. He was a prefect. A prefect was another word for a governor, but they were typically ruling over what were called imperial provinces. Province was the basic unit of Roman government, and the imperial provinces were the ones kind of out on the frontiers. They were away from Italy. The ones around Rome were the prize plums, and only certain select people that had either bribed their way or had bought their way, or had friends in high places, got those. And Pilate was not one of those. But he was a prefect. As a matter of fact, in 1961, in the city of Caesarea, which is on the coast, the Mediterranean coast, they discovered this inscription, which is this is the only, I don't know if you can see it, the second line there has the name Pilatus, and the third line has a fragment of the word Prefectus. This is the only archaeological evidence that we have outside the Bible, any statement outside the Bible about Pilate. Tangible evidence, we got written evidence. But they found this in 1961, indicating that he was, in fact, it says it has Pilatus, Prefectus, and Iudea, which would be Judea, is on there. So here we've got an actual, and you, if you go to Caesarea, which is on the coast of the Mediterranean, it's about 100 miles northwest of Jerusalem. This is actually a replica. The real one's in the Israeli Museum. You can see this, all right? Now, he more than likely had that done himself. But he was a man of power, of wealth, and of privilege. He was in a very elite class of Romans. A couple other things about him. He had what was called the Imperium. That was the Roman. These guys, if you study Roman history, and some of you probably have forgotten more about it than I know, they were just insane with details and orders, and they made any kind of organizational seminar look like a garbage dump compared to the way they set up life. They had names for everything. They're the ones that came up with the grid system for streets. I mean, and the postal system, they took the Babylonian postal system and made it even better. They, you know, had running water. They had all kinds of stuff. But this word imperium was given to certain Roman officials. What did it mean? It meant that they had the power of Rome without getting Roman approval. Capital punishment. What Pilate did with Jesus was completely within his will. And was also completely within the power that was given to him by Rome. They had some power of taxation. This is interesting, but Pilate had control of the religious life of Jerusalem. The high priest, if you remember this from the book of Exodus and Leviticus, high priests used to be of Aaronic descent. They had to be descendants of Aaron. Tribe of Levi, but that didn't make them a high priest. That would allow them to be a Levite, but not a high priest. They had to be a descendant of Aaron. Somewhere in that fuzzy period between the close of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, the high priesthood got very, very corrupted, and it became a form of, like, almost like a king in Palestine. And then when Rome took over and started ruling using governors and prefects, they took upon themselves the in Jerusalem the authority to appoint high priests. There's one Roman prefect that had four high priests in 2 years. And the reason was because every time he appointed one, another one would come along and bribe him to appoint them. And so he had this little prophet thing going, right? But the prefect also kept the garments of the high priest. Is that a big deal? That's a huge deal. All right, it's kind of like Superman or Spider-Man. They're really not much good without their costume. And the high priest had no authority, just kind of standing. He was respected, but he couldn't function as the high priest without the high priestly garments. And the Roman prefect let those out four times a year for Passover, for the Feast of Tabernacles, and a few other things like that. And so they had control over that. He also wasn't there all the time. We tend to think of Pilate and Jerusalem as kind of going together like a hand and a glove, and that's not true. He lived in Caesarea, which was a city obviously named after Caesar, but it was built by Herod the Great. And it was an engineering feat. Absolutely amazing how they built the city. Herod created a harbor in a place where there wasn't one, and he named it after Caesar. And that's where Pilate lived. In a palatial environment on the Mediterranean coast. You can go there today. There's still a ton. I've got, matter of fact, I think I have a slide here. Yeah, this is the coastline of Caesarea today. It's just gorgeous, just gorgeous. And so Jerusalem for him would be kind of like going to some really rural, rotten place if you were used to the Roman way of life and you had your main dwelling on the Mediterranean. But he wasn't there all the time. which meant that when he was there and was enforcing his rule, it would have been resented. All right, now this to me is kind of the smoke and the mirrors, because when you look at the New Testament and we look particularly at this passage that we're studying tonight, it's very obvious that this man of prestige, of power, and of privilege, and the person who controls the religious climate of Palestine is doing anything but that. He's not in charge. It's very obvious that the Jews are in charge. The Sanhedrin, which you, if you know, is the Jewish Supreme Court, more or less, was made up predominantly of Sadducees. They were the aristocratic, wealthy class in Jerusalem. And it was very similar to the Roman Senate. And so with Pilate there, and him having being kind of buddy-buddy with the Sadducees more than he was with the Pharisees, they were strong religious nationalists. They were a lot like you and I probably would be. He wasn't really a perfect prefect. And I want to show you why. This is some stuff you have got to understand to make sense of the passage we just read. And some of you probably already know some of this. But if you get this for the first time, it's like the windows are going to open up in terms of what was really happening outside his headquarters that early morning with the Jews. And why, in a very real sense, there is no earthly reason for Pilate to have done anything other than what he did. There really isn't. Let me show you what I mean. He starts off his rule. he was prefect over Judea from 26 to 36 AD. There was 14 prefects, Roman prefects, from 6, the death of Herod, in 6 AD to 66 AD. There's 14 of them in there. And Pilate was in there for a decade. And his inaugural thing, the first thing that he did, basically set the course for those 10 years and really contributed to a lot of what we saw in this passage. He came into town from Caesarea now. He marched into town at night, which was not a problem. But all of his soldiers riding on horses had standards. They had these poles that had flags on them. And on the top of the pole was a small metal bust of the emperor. And the Jews, if you understand that what we call the Ten Commandments, they were totally opposed to any kind of icon, any kind of statuette, any kind of anything. In a very real sense, iconography became blasphemy with Judaism. You had got the ancient Near Eastern gods were making statues like, little Debbies. And the Jews couldn't do anything. And so when he came marching in at night, they didn't know it, but the next morning when they saw these standards, they went ballistic. The Jews went ballistic because they accused him of bringing pagan idols into town, which was true. The emperor was worshipped. Emperor worship was common. And they told him they didn't want him to do it. He wouldn't listen to him. They followed him all the way back to Caesarea, arguing with him for 5 days. They got back to Caesarea, and he had finally had it. He summoned all the Jewish leaders, had them meet him in the amphitheater at Caesarea, surrounded them with Roman soldiers, and told them to either shut up and go home or he was going to kill them. And they took their robes and pulled their robes down like this and exposed their throats and said, "We would rather die than worship idols." And he backed off. So here you have the guy who's supposed to be in charge, the guy that's supposed to be controlling the religious climate of Palestine, loses. He lost in his first face-off with the Jews at the very beginning in 26. All right, now this is probably at least 4 years, 3 to 4 years before the encounter with Jesus. All right, that left two things in the mouth of the Jews. It left a tremendous sense of bitterness towards Pilate and a sweet taste of victory in terms of who's going to run the show in Jerusalem. Second thing that happened, he had some public works projects that didn't what? They didn't work. He decided that he was going to be a benefactor for the city and he was going to build an aqueduct. Jerusalem's had problems with water since the time of Hezekiah, and he was going to build this aqueduct and bring in fresh water. It would have been good for the temple because of all the mikvahs in there, all of the ceremonial baths, and all they use water a lot in their worship, and it would have been good for the citizens, and you would think this would be great. Well, he did it, but he made a big mistake. He used temple funds to do it. So he took money out of the temple treasury to build this aqueduct. And the Jews, you can imagine, they rioted. And so there was a demonstration and rioting going on in the streets. And how did Pilate deal with it? Pilate invented, maybe, I don't know if he invented, but he used what we would call plain clothes policemen. And he took his soldiers and had them put on normal peasant clothes with concealed weapons. And they went out into the city, and at the right time, he had turned them and unleashed them on the Jews, clubbing them, stabbing them, killing them. And this did not stand well in terms of his Nielsen ratings. If they were going to do an entrance or exit poll on Pilate that week, he was kind of toast on a rope. I mean, he was really in trouble with the Jews. That was the second thing he did, all right? Third thing he did was he had some shields that didn't what? They didn't shield. They didn't protect him. He brought in a whole series of what are we now know are called votive shields. They were Roman shields that had the name of Tiberius and Pontius Pilatus on it, all right? But the fact that it had Tiberius's name on it upset the Jews because they felt that that was idolatrous, and he hung them up in Herod's palace. And they complained, and he wouldn't listen to them. So they did what all good children do when they get upset. They told their dad. They wrote a letter to Tiberius Caesar in Rome. And Tiberius contacted Pilate and said, now you need to understand something about Tiberius. Tiberius has a reputation of being the most paranoid ruler in the first century on the planet. He was just scared to death about everything, particularly losing control so far away. But he made Pilate move these shields from Herod's palace to the temple of Augustus in Caesarea. That's how we know that they were something spiritual about him. He didn't put him in Pilate's palace. He put him in Augustus's temple. And so the Jews were probably accurate. Now, this all happened prior to the passage we read. So when you hear the Jews say stuff like, anyone that sides with Jesus is no friend of Caesar's, you can imagine what's going through Pilate's mind. I mean, he is going crazy hearing that. And that's why John says, when he heard this statement, he did such and such. All right. These Jewish leaders were absolute, just brilliant in the way they blackmailed this man. When they said, we have no king but Caesar. Remember that statement? All right. That's a direct violation of what's called the 11th benediction. There was 18 benedictions that Jewish men prayed in the morning. And number 11 was, you and you alone are our king, O Lord. It's exactly what Samuel said to them in the book of Samuel. It's what God said to them in the book of Judges. I will be your king. And they prayed it back. So you have these Pharisees that are denying their own religion in a very real sense, but they are playing with Pilate like a dog, a kid with a stick and a dog. Man, they have got him in a corner. All right. So you're Pilate, what do you do? All right, isn't it pretty clear to you in this passage that Pilate came to the conclusion that Jesus was innocent? Don't you see that? I mean, he tries at least three times in the Gospel of John to get Jesus off the hook. He tries just to release him. That doesn't work. He tries flogging him, and that doesn't work. He tries switching off Barabbas and him, and it doesn't work. And then he finds out that Jesus said, apparently claimed that he was the Son of God. You know, I mean, if we saw this on video, you get this impression that Pilate's just going in and out and in and out and in and out. You know, he's outside, he's talking to everybody, and he finds out something new. He says, come here, I got to talk to you. You know, takes him back inside. Where are you from? Where are you from? Jesus doesn't say anything. Doesn't answer. All right? I mean, when Jesus doesn't talk to a person, that's a serious thing. That's a serious thing. I mean, this is not in your notes, but I think we need to be careful that we always leave our hearts open so he keeps talking to us. I really do. We just have this assumption that because he's God and he loves me that I can do whatever I want and he'll just keep talking to me. But when Jesus doesn't talk, he didn't talk to Herod. Remember that? Herod called him in, wanted him to do some juggling or something, and Jesus wouldn't do it. Wouldn't he talk to him? He wouldn't talk to the high priests in the first interrogation, and he doesn't talk to Pilate here. And Pilate gets freaked out. He says, do you not know that I have the authority to crucify you or to turn you free? And that was true. That's the imperium. And Jesus says, you wouldn't have any authority unless my Father had given it to you. And I think his blood went cold at that point. But then he comes out. And he says, shall I crucify your king? And he says, we. Doesn't say, the Pharisees aren't talking to Pilate. We have no king but Caesar. And anyone who's this person's friend is no friend to Caesar's. And the unspoken question is what? Pilate? Are you Caesar's friend? Are you Caesar's friend? Now, you can get your head chopped off for treason. You can't. Herod the Great was called king by Augustus. All right? His son, Herod Antipas, asked to be called king by the next emperor, and he got banished. So you just didn't mess with, you know, any kind of unfaithfulness to Rome would get you in trouble. And Pilate's already got, I mean, it's like if they send a letter, they pull the Pilate file out of the folder and they start paging through it and they go, oh my gosh, look at this. He's got this, he had this, right? And then it gets worse. He did a fourth thing. This was after the time of Jesus. I forgot about this. I put this in. This is important. He had an anti-Semitic sponsor. If you had a sponsor in Rome, which was someone very powerful, you were called their client. And their job was to kind of protect you and promote you and do things for you. He had a guy in Rome whose name was Sejanus, and this guy hated Jews. And so Pilate's faced with the possibility of losing his sponsorship if it turns out that he is perceived as being kind of pro-Jewish. It wouldn't look good on his political resume, could cause him problems, all right? And this the Jews may or may not have known about, but Pilate knew about it, all right? Then he had a fourth thing. This was the one I was going to show you. This one happened a little bit later. And the reason I show you this is because this is the last thing we want to look at with Pilate. There was a riot that developed in Samaria over a guy that was kind of claiming to be a Messiah. And he did the same deal, sent in soldiers, start killing people like crazy. And they complained to the guy who was Roman legate, he was called. He was above a prefect who was ruling Syria. They complained to him because they had had good relationships with that legate. He went to Tiberius again. Tiberius summoned Pilate to Rome. And what happened was Tiberius died before Pilate got there, but Pilate's basically never heard of again. He just kind of drops out of the history books right here. And so I tell you all this simply to help us understand that when the Jews put Pilate was on trial that day, not Jesus. Pilate was on trial that day, not Jesus. And I don't know if there's any human reason why Pilate should have done anything different than he did. If you and I were in that situation and we were not believers, matter of fact, we were diehard pagans, we have to say, well, why? We say, well, he didn't follow his conscience. And we use Pilate as a good example about not following your conscience. There was nothing for him to gain by following his conscience other than dying with a clear conscience. And I think he would rather stay alive with a guilty one, was what he decided. And more than likely, we're probably not too far removed from that in truth. All right, what about the words in this passage? There's some interesting stuff in here. We're going to go through this a little bit quickly. But this idea of the judgment seat is mentioned in John chapter 19, I think it's verse 13. It's the Greek word bima, and it shows up a lot in the New Testament. It was the actual place that a person sat to execute judgment. This is a slide here of a bima seat in Attica, Greece. This is what it looked like. It was a raised platform, and Pilate's would have been up even higher because it was in outside kind of a kingly palace there, Herod's palace, and he sat down there. And when people that were in authority sat on the bema seat, they were making final pronouncements. All right. Second thing, it's used of Pilate with Jesus. It's also used of a guy named Gallio. If you look in the book of Acts, Paul gets in trouble. I mean, he's in trouble everywhere he goes, but he's in the region of Achaia, and he's there, and this proconsul, that's a Roman official higher than Pilate, sits on the bema seat and starts to pass judgment, and a riot breaks out in the city. It's used of God himself. We will all stand before the judgment seat of God in the book of Romans chapter 14. That's the word bema. Paul uses it of Jesus Christ in 2 Corinthians 5:10. We will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, the bema seat. The bema seat. And so this notion of bema is a really, really strong concept in the scriptures. It has to do with pronouncing judgment. All right. Now I need to tell you this because it's interesting, and I have to tell you I don't. It's probably not true. I wished it were. This is one of those things. If it were true, man, you could write a book about it. But the Greek verb where it says that Pilate sat on the judgment seat, you can translate it without any problem like this, without messing with the Greek or anything. Pilate sat Jesus on the bema seat. You could say that. The very next phrase in the Gospel of John is, Pilate says, "Behold your king." And there's some scholars, I talked to two of them today, and they came out on both sides of the argument, so I don't know what to tell you, but if that is even possible, that he did that to mock Jesus, the irony is absolutely amazing. That the nation of Israel and the nation of Rome are mocking Jesus sitting on a bema seat when the scripture says there's going to come a day when every knee will bow at the king. When he said, "Behold your king," it was true. He was the king, not of Israel, but he was the King of Kings. And his Pilate's mockery ends up being a prophecy, doesn't it? When he says, "Behold your king," because Jesus really was, he really was their king. And everyone, at some point, was going to kneel. If he was sitting on the bema seat, it has a tremendous irony. In John 18:37, Jesus says, "For this reason I was born and I have come into the world to testify to the truth." Both of these verbs are in the perfect tense. I've mentioned this to you before. Perfect tense just means something was going on, it stopped, but the effect of it just keeps on going and going and going. And what Jesus is basically saying isn't how he got here. I was born and I have come. The point that Jesus is saying is, I am now here. I have a mission. We get that from the next verse. Twice he says, "For this," the word "reason's" not in there, or "for this purpose." We have purpose in our Bibles that just says, "For this I was born. For this I came." And Jesus repeats it. He says it twice because he's trying to make a point. And the point is, I have a mission. I was born for this. I have come for this. What's the this? To testify to the truth. And those who are of the truth hear my voice. And Pilate said, "What's the truth? What is truth?" And I think at this point, Pilate thinks he's dealing with some itinerant Jewish philosopher that's floating around talking about truth, beauty, and justice. And it gets real gnarly as he moves his way through this interrogation. Another one, this idea of "listens to my voice." It's in the present tense in the Greek. And I think I've shared that with you before. In the Greek, present tense means something is going on and on and on and on. I like to use the word "lifestyle" for those kinds of verbs. They're verbs that talk about a habit or a lifestyle. or a lifestyle habit. And Jesus isn't talking about someone who keeps listening and listening and listening and listening. It's that same word that we used before. It means to hear and understand. He's talking here about obeying. Jesus is saying the person who is of the truth makes a habit of listening to me with the goal of obeying me. And for this reason, I was born. For this reason, I have come to testify to the truth. To testify to the truth. And then he says in here, those who are of the truth. And it's a really powerful little preposition. It's a little word, ek. And it means to come out of the center of something. To come right out of the middle of it. And he's talking about people here who are, when he uses this phrase, of the truth, he's talking about a certain kind of person. This is only shows up three times in the entire New Testament, this phrase, of the truth. Three times. And all three of them are used by the Apostle John. One here, and two in the book of 1 John. He's talking about a certain kind of person that habitually listens to God with the goal towards obeying, all right? One of the last words we want to look at, he says, I've come to bear witness. And the word here, the verb is martyreo. It's where we get our English word martyr. It's where we get our English word martyr. And Jesus isn't saying, I've come to die in this verse. He says that someplace else. He basically says, I have come to tell the truth about the truth, and I am the truth. I have come for this reason I was born. For this reason I have come. And I am now here and I have a mission. And my mission is to testify, to tell you what I know about the truth. And those who are really out of the truth, they make a habitual habit of listening to me, understanding me, and obeying me. And then Pilate answers this enormous, enormous statement with, what is truth? And we don't get the distinct impression that he was looking for an answer because he doesn't get one from Jesus. Okay, you take this person, you take this interrogation, you take this entire topic about truth. What's it got to do with us here in the 21st century? Let me show you a couple things. This is a great piece of art about Pilate, isn't it? A couple things. First, and I'm going to get a little philosophical here, but not for very long. Truth is propositional. That means it needs words. That's all it means. If you ever hear the phrase propositional truth, it just means truth that has words associated with it. It's a big topic in Christian books and Christian theology and stuff. But it's true. Truth is propositional. It needs words. It depends on words. That means there's a valid place for proclaiming truth. We call that evangelism. There's a valid place for it because truth is dependent upon words. Truth is housed in words. And so therefore, I can share the gospel in words. All right? How can anyone hear unless someone preaches? And how can anyone preach unless they're sent? And blessed are the feet of those who carry the good news. There's also a valid place for defending or validating the truth. We call that apologetics. This should be nothing new to you. The American church has written a cajillion books about this. We have seminars about it. We have video curriculum about propositional truth. And this is the whole thing that gets everyone worked up about postmodernism, because postmodernism attacks this, all right? This is valuable. This is important. But this is not what Jesus was talking about. Truth also is incarnational. It needs deeds. Now we get real nervous when we hear this. We have demonized deeds and works. And I'm going to try to clarify some of that. But truth is propositional. Don't get me wrong. It's a two-sided coin. Part of it is that it depends upon words or such a thing as true ideas. Theology is truth. And that's words and doctrine and so on. But it's also incarnational. And it depends on deeds. This was the whole point of the incarnation. It was the whole point of the incarnation. If you read John 1, you hear that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's kind of propositional. Verse 14, the Word became flesh and it dwelt among us. And we have beheld his glory. Glory as of the only Son with the Father. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Jesus looked at Philip and he said, Philip, have I been with you so long? Anyone who has seen me has what? Has seen the Father. Hebrews 1, in these long ago and many times and in many ways, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. He is the exact representation of his glory. Jesus was God in a body. When Jesus said, I am the truth, he was not talking just about ideas and propositions. Matter of fact, if you read, and I put a passage in, if you look at 1 John, there's a passage in there about 1 John. The other place where it talks about being of the truth, it all has to do with the way we treat people. That's how John says, that's how we know whether or not we're of the truth. Is by the way we live our lives. All right? Let me unpack this. This is also the point of our own transformation. By point, I don't mean where it happens. I mean, this is what it's all about. We all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. There's a change that's occurring, that we are becoming more and more and more like Jesus. What's the point of that? Why do that? Paul tells us in the next chapter. We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Now listen to this. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. We call that sanctification. But our sanctification, and I want you to get this, is a really cool way to think of it. Our sanctification is God editing the incarnational truth in you and in me over time, so that it comes closer and closer and closer and closer to the real truth. That's what sanctification is. It's God editing the incarnational truth in me over time, so that I increasingly resemble the truth. That's why how we live is so vital. All right? You and I are saved by grace alone. We bring nothing to the table but sin-soaked hands. And we come away with the righteousness of Jesus forever. All right? You can't touch that. You can't add to it. You can't take away from it. That's called justification. But from the time that happens till the time Jesus comes back, he's in the process of changing me to resemble him. And that's all about deeds. It's all about the life of Jesus being manifested in me. And so Pilate's question, what is truth? He was looking at it. Jesus couldn't say, well, there's 5 points to it, and I've got a great PowerPoint presentation. I can show you. He was looking at it. I am the truth, Jesus said. All right. True truth is both words to proclaim and a life to be seen. That's the two-sided coin. That's the two-sided coin. And I think you can guess what my next thought is on this. Which of those two sides of the coin do you think we have emphasized in this country? We have emphasized propositional truth. We have thought to ourselves that truth is something that we protect and defend and pass on, which it is. But that's only half the coin. It's also the life of Jesus being lived out through the power of the Holy Spirit in the lives of those that claim to call him Lord. And the truth is, when these two forms of truth disagree, the world is justified in rejecting the words. When these two forms of truth disagree, the world is justified in rejecting the words. How can I say that? In John 13:34, Jesus said, "If you love one another by this, all men will know that you are my disciples." In John 17, he says, "I and them, and you and me and them, that they might be one, just as we are one, that the world might know that you have sent me." And when Christians are unloving, when we are unloving, when we are un-Christ-like, we give the world, it doesn't change the truth, but we give them the grounds to tell to reject the word part of it. Jesus called that hypocrisy. It's when the life and the words are not saying the same truths. God wants my life and my mouth to match. We made a little cliche about walking the walk and talking the talk, and we kind of laugh about it, and it's kind of cute, but it's much more profound than that. It's at the center of what God wants to do in our lives while we're still here. Three questions, and we'll close. Number one, which form of truth-telling do those in my life need right now? The people in your life, believers or unbelievers, do they need words? Some do. Do they need deeds? Some do. It's important that we take time to figure out which one it is. Second question, which types are they getting? Which type are they getting? Some of us are heavy on words and weak on deeds. Some are heavy on deeds and weak on words. Truth is a two-sided coin. Truth is a two-sided coin. Big question at the bottom, though, is are they beholding the King? It's interesting, isn't it? Pilate started out, "Behold the man." He ends up, "Behold your King." I think he was serious about the first one and was really confused about the second one. But truth simply means that people can behold the King. Father,